Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The mass protests in Ukraine continue to receive widespread media coverage here in the U.S. and around the globe. The protests began after President Viktor Yanukovych postponed plans to sign a trade agreement with the European Union and decided to strengthen his ties with Russia instead. The protesters are often described as being pro-Europe in the media. So how accurate is that narrative? Joining us to talk about coverage is Fred Weir, Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Fred has been covering Russia and the former Soviet Union since 1988. He reports that Ukraine teetered on the edge between violence and reconciliation this week as riot police forcibly dismantled barricades and forced protesters back from the president's office, while President Viktor Yanukovych called for national dialogue. Now nearing its third week, the standoff between the president and thousands of shivering protesters who have occupied Kiev's Independence Square and sporadically blockaded buildings has paralyzed the government and nudged the near-bankrupt country toward default. And Fred Weir joins us from Moscow. Hi, Fred. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
And here in the United States, a budget deal was announced by House Budget Committee Chair Paul Ryan, a Republican from Wisconsin, and Senate Budget Committee Chair Patty Murray, a Democrat from Washington. The House passed the budget in a vote of 332-94, and it's expected to pass the Senate soon. The New York Times called it a truce in the spending battles that have paralyzed Congress for nearly 3 years, as leaders in both parties sought to marginalize hardline conservatives opposed to any compromise. Both sides agreed to $63 billion in sequester relief, which is not an end to sequestration, and $23 billion will go toward deficit reductions. The bill does not extend unemployment benefits, and that means that checks will stop arriving for 1.3 million jobless Americans just 3 days after Christmas. The bill also fails to close a single tax loophole. The nation's John Nichols calls it an irresponsible and dysfunctional deal, but most in the media say it was a welcomed compromise that prevented another government shutdown. In an interview with CNN's Jake Tapper, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi said she told House members that the deal may be unsatisfactory, but they should, quote, embrace the suck, meaning that the deal sucks. Joining us to talk about this is Michael McAuliffe. He's senior congressional correspondent with The Huffington Post. Hi, Michael. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for bringing me on.
Nice to have you. And we're also joined by Mike Elk. He's a labor journalist within These Times. Mike has also been covering the growing movement for low-wage workers, and we'll also talk to Mike about coverage of that movement. Hey, Mike. Welcome back to the show.
Always great to be on your show, Rose.
Always great to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Mike, why don't we start off with you, Mike Elk. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Josh Idelson did an excellent piece this week on the union drive at MSNBC that kind of gets to some of the issues that a lot of people in the journalism industry are dealing with. And I think it took a lot of guts for Josh to do what he did. Basically, there's some workers in this unit called Peacock Unit that are writers, that are underpaid, that are organizing with the Writers Guild of America East. And there's been several illegal retaliations against them. And so the writers have called on the progressive hosts of MSNBC to meet with them to discuss the union issues. The only of all the hosts that have met with the union workers is Chris Hayes of the Chris Hayes Show, and that's to Chris' credit, because Chris is a stand-up principal guy and a friend. But many people did not meet with that. And one of the people that did not was Ed Schultz. And after Ed Schultz didn't meet with Josh, meet with the workers, he called out Josh Idelson in a series of rants on his radio show and on Twitter and email, and accused Josh of all kind of lies and just really bizarro stuff, and accused Josh of class envy. And I was just on his show earlier, defending Josh, because I think Josh is a good guy, and defending David Sirota, who Schultz went on this bizarre rant against. And Schultz, who's this champion of workers, won't say if he supports this union drive, and instead rather slander reporters. And so I want to give a big kudo to Josh Idelson. I know I've criticized him at times on this show, actually, for some of his reporting that I disagreed with. But there's a way to disagree as reporters and do it in a polite way and do it in a way that's honorable.
And
I gosh, did a great job, and it's unfair the kind of weird, bizarro world attack that Ed Schultz is doing on him and David Sirota myself.
What are these workers calling for, just quickly?
They just want to join a union. They just want the simple universal human right to join a union.
Okay, so
they work for MSNBC, which is the leading liberal voice in America.
Wow, so they're not union?
Nope. Nobody at MSNBC is union. They have, every time I go in there, there's guys that are saying, oh, I'm so glad to be working today. I'm an independent contractor, with the cameramen. They're treated very poorly. And this is what happens in the journalism industry because so many people want to become journalists. So many people want to have a voice and be able to say something. So people get exploited. Mm-hmm. And I think this was a great example of look at the people at the top. Look at the TV hosts like Chris Hayes and Ed Schultz and Rachel Maddow who are making millions of dollars as TV hosts and espousing progressive ideas, and they won't even meet with a bunch of people trying to unionize that are facing illegal retaliation. Chris Hayes was the only one who did it, and that's much to Chris's credit.
So are these mostly contractors that MSNBC is hiring? Is that why they're not union?
Yeah, they're independent contract. They're in this Peacock unit.
Okay.
They're contractors that they're hiring, and it's a bad workers' rights practice. And here's a network espousing workers' rights, owned by Comcast, making millions in profits, and they can't even treat the folks they're supposed to be covering progressive issues in a way that's progressive.
Mm. Well, yeah, and sadly, so many journalists are contractors, meaning we have to buy our own health care and have no retirement plans.
Yeah, and it's important for folks in our industry to unionize. It's very important, and it's very risky. What Josh did in writing this article, he may be blacklisted from MSNBC. I may be blacklisted from MSNBC.
Well, and just quickly, Mike, because you write for In These Times. Are In These Times reporters unionized?
We just turned in union cards last Friday.
Ah.
We got a very nice letter back from the staff, from the board, and we're in the process of establishing a union there.
And Michael McAuliffe, what about you all over at the Huffington Post? Are reporters there unionized?
No, not at all.
Is this something you talk about?
No, not a whole lot. But we've been lucky so far, at least in my part of the world, they treat us very well.
Do you mind me asking if you all have health care?
Yeah, we do. We have your basic corporate America Online health care plan.
Oh, right, because you're now owned by AOL.
Correct.
Huh. Well, you're lucky you have health care.
Yes.
So is this something that you all talk about? Is this important to you, or is it because you have benefits that you don't really bring it up?
It's an interesting question because we have the whole unpaid bloggers thing over at the Huffington Post. But I would suspect that since the employer is treating us well, that's probably the biggest answer right there.
Right. And I'll ask Fred in just a minute. But first, what did you see this week that you thought was done well in the media? Michael.
Well, there were a number of things that I thought were very good. First of all, a little hat tip to Jason, our Jason Cherkis, who did a wonderful look at how a one bullet killed a young man at Temple University not quite 10 years ago, and how that has absolutely shattered the lives of his entire family. And it's almost studs Terkel-ish, to borrow a phrase from one of my colleagues, in that it goes through this whole story almost entirely using excerpts from detailed interviews that he did with all the folks who knew this person and cared about him. And there's video. It's really compelling, and I'm a fairly cynical person when it comes to reading news, but it made me get all teary-eyed and choked up.
Mm.
The other was the Milwaukee Journal out in did this really long investigative report on the ATF, and they going through tons of court documents and newspaper stories. They looked at how the ATF was setting up these fronts, basically in sting operations. They seem to have gone entirely off the rails to the point where they were employing mentally disabled people to sort of try and spread the message of these shops, and then the people who they employed would end up getting charged with crimes. It's really long. I'm not doing it justice, but I believe you can still find it on their website.
I was just searching for it. It looks like it's got a lot of pickup.
Yeah, it did. It got quite a lot of pickup, and of course there's the inevitable sort of right-wing pickup that says, see, the ATF and Obama's out of control, but it's really much better than a simple political ideological take.
Wow. And I also just wanted to give kudos to Mother Jones because they've done some amazing reporting on the children that have been killed by guns over the last year. And it's kind of shocking. They have all the photos and then they look at how these kids have been killed since the year anniversary of the Sandy Hook massacre is tomorrow, which is getting a lot of media attention. So thanks for that. We'll put those links on our website right after the show. And Fred Weir, just quickly, are reporters at the Christian Science Monitor unionized, since we're on this topic?
I do not know. I've never actually been to Boston, but I am a contract writer, and I'm all alone in Moscow, their Moscow bureau. So it has never come up for me.
And what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, from my bailiwick, which is Russia, I think the most important story and portentous one is the Kremlin's decision, like almost thunderbolt surprise decision, to liquidate a huge part of its media assets, the ones that broadcast to overseas, like the Ria Novosti and the Voice of Russia radio station. It has many, many, many layers to it, but the most serious one, in my view, that has not been really discussed, is that Ria Novosti, one of these agencies, is one of the main broadcasters, providers of basic news. It's a basic news service to hundreds of local Russian newspapers, radio, and TV stations. There are only three wire services like this, and Ria Novosti is by far the best of them. And however the Kremlin plans to restructure this, it is almost certain that domestic service of Ria Novosti will be gone within a few months. And I think that's really, really tragic for Russian media.
Why is that? Can you just give us an overview of the current state of Russian media?
I think that the main reason is Ukraine, the subject you want to talk about tonight, that there has been long a debate in the upper echelons of Russian power about their financing of media organizations. And Ria Novosti was the one that has had more than $1 billion invested in it, and it has been trying to become a competitive international news service. And that means it's been professional, or it's been far more professional, objective, more what we call regular journalism and not propaganda. And it's had a lot of enemies at the top because people say, look, you know, we, the taxpayer, the Kremlin, are funding this service which is criticizing us. It's quoting our enemies. It's publishing stuff that is not in the Russian national interest, at least as they would define it. And now, with Ukraine once again becoming turbulent and so on, Ria Novosti was covering those demonstrations. It was going in and talking to protesters and opposition leaders and quoting them in its stories. And I think President Putin just had a fit. One day, someone told him, look what they're writing, and you're paying for this, and he decided to shut them down.
So this is going to be a Russian version of Russia Today?
The new agency, which is being created on the ruins of the several properties that are being liquidated, will almost certainly be some sort of propaganda agency, much more explicitly propaganda than was the others, the Voice of Russia and Ria Novosti. And it's not clear what kind of shape it will take as yet, but it will broadcast mainly to the world. And it will be under the control of a very, very hard-line, homophobic, anti-Western racist named Dmitry Kiselyov. He's a Russian talk show host, and we know him very well. And anything that passes under his supervision will be straightforward propaganda.
I understand that he caused a lot of outrage by saying the organs of homosexuals should not be used in transplants.
Yes, in fact, they should be burned.
Oh, wow.
Is what he said. Yeah, he, no, that's just one of his many controversial statements.
Hmm. We're talking with Fred Weir, Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, and Fred will be with us for about another 10 minutes. So if you have any questions or comments about Russian media and the protests in Ukraine, which continue to receive widespread media attention, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Michael McAuliffe, senior congressional correspondent with the Huffington Post, and Mike Elk, a labor reporter with In These Times. So why don't we talk about what's happening in Ukraine? Mass protests, they're getting so much attention here in the U.S. and around the world. A lot of people in the media are calling them pro-Europe because they came out into the streets after the president decided not to sign a trade agreement with the EU. First off, how accurate is this, Fred? What are you hearing from the protesters?
It is a power struggle. And the stark outlines, or ideological outlines of it, are that Ukraine will sooner or later have to make what's called a civilizational choice. Because Russia has become much stronger in the past decade. It is creating it has created its own customs union with three other post-Soviet states, and will be going on to create the Eurasian Economic Union, which will be a political economic union, not the Soviet Union redux or anything like that, but still strong Russian-led economic union, which will be in rivalry with the EU. And on the other hand, the EU has become much more insistent about Ukraine becoming part of its economic space. There are especially countries like Poland and the Czech Republic who've been very strident about bringing Ukraine in under the EU umbrella. And the truth is that Ukraine is in no way ready to become part of the EU and does not want to become part of the Russian Union. What the Ukrainians really want, I think, is to continue what they've been doing for the past 20 years, which is trying to build their own statehood, well, playing the East off against the West, trading both ways. And the statistics show that Ukraine's biggest single trading partner is Russia by far, but the total trade with Russia is about equaled by the total trade turnover with the 26 countries of the EU. So Yanukovych, I think, faced a lot of different economic realities when he decided not to sign that agreement with the EU, but that was a pretext, and it's an important pretext, but it's not the whole story. That's why the opposition decided to take to the streets.
And what are you hearing from protesters, Fred? What are their demands? What are they talking about?
At first, their demand was that he should go and sign this agreement, but it quickly morphed into he must resign and we should have early elections. It is unfortunate that a lot of the opposition have seen the opportunity to restage the Orange Revolution, which happened 9 years ago. But in that case, there was real electoral fraud in Ukraine, and the protesters forced a replay of elections. In this case, it's a little murkier because there is no doubt that President of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych, was legally and legitimately elected. I covered that election, and I well remember that all the Western observers pronounced it free and fair. So it is kind of problematic that the opposition has, at least so far, become quite intransigent in their demand that he should resign and we should have a replay of a new election, fresh election. Because that would probably undermine Ukraine's fairly fragile democratic institution.
Michael McAuliffe and Mike Elk, do you have any questions for Fred? I don't know if you've been following this issue, but before we let him go, do you have any questions?
I'm just kind of curious where he thinks this will go. I mean, does this turn into some sort of almost a counter-revolution, or where's it go?
Where it's going is impossible to predict, and the government, Yanukovych's government, has lost its political will. At least their idea was to clear the demonstrators off the streets and break down the barricades. But they tried it before. There was violence, and they backed off. It's a difficult situation. But if they don't somehow deal with the protesters, make them at least stay in a park or something, not blockade the central government buildings and central main street of Kiev, it's just a problem, a serious problem, and it will paralyze the Ukrainian government. So I don't know. We're either going to see a crackdown or the government of Yanukovych will back off. And either way, Ukraine will fall into much more serious turmoil.
Well, Fred, thank you so much for staying up and joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. That is Fred Weir. He's Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, covering what's happening in Ukraine and then the media overhaul in Russia. And you can find his reports at yourcallradio.org. And sticking around for the rest of the hour is Michael McAuliffe, senior congressional correspondent for the Huffington Post. He's been covering the budget. And Mike Elk, a labor journalist for In These Times. He's been covering the growing low-wage worker movement. So let's talk about the budget. Earlier this week, we had an announcement from Congressman Paul Ryan and Senator Patty Murray. And Michael, this is being sort of hailed in the media as a compromise. Isn't this nice that that both parties can get along and do something together and we will not see a government shutdown? And now what we're seeing are the media really focusing on this fight between the Tea Party and Republicans. And I've heard John Boehner in the media say over and over again, you know, they're misleading their followers. I think they're pushing our members in places where they don't want to be. And I think they've lost all credibility, talking about these far right groups that criticize the compromise. So it seems like that is the main theme here. What are your thoughts on how this is being covered? And what about the details of this bill?
Well, the details of the bill kind of get lost in the wash. I mean, you can find them if you go looking around for it, but it's certainly not the main theme of any of the coverage. So I tried to look at some of those details with our friend Arthur Delaney on the unemployment issue yesterday, and there are plenty to look at. You know, hospitals down the road at the end of this deal are sort of where some of the money comes from to pay for it through the Medicare program. Providers will have to continue to live under sequester for a couple more years. There is no unemployment insurance deal to extend the benefits after December 28th, so that's 1.3 million, I believe, who will lose any sort of income, you know, right before New Year's. So that's not so great. And there's all kinds of little writers and things in there, too, that I have not really seen developed especially well. So there's plenty in there not to like, but I think Nancy Pelosi's opinion of embrace the suck is pretty much what most folks on Capitol Hill are doing with it, although there is a little bit of rebellion in the Senate on the Republican side right now.
Well, we'll talk about that after the break, and I'd love to get more details on Medicare reimbursements, because we just did a show about this week, and a lot of people are concerned about whether or not doctors will be taking new patients under the Affordable Care Act. So we'll talk about that after the break, and we'll talk about more details in this budget bill beyond the political back and forth with Michael McAuliffe, senior congressional correspondent with the Huffington Post, and Mike Elk, labor journalist with In These Times. What did you think of the coverage of the budget? And then we'll also talk about the growing movement for low-wage workers. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
All the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org. And we invite you to highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation about the alarming rate of deportations under President Obama and prospects for immigration reform. Almost 2 million undocumented immigrants have been deported under the Obama administration, far more than under the Bush administration. Immigrants' rights activists are being arrested. They're taking part in massive demonstrations urging the president to stop this. So how much power does he have? What explains this policy? And what is the status of immigration reform? That's Monday. And then Tuesday, we will talk about CEO pay. For the first time ever, 10 CEOs now make over $100 million in the United States. And we'll talk about why this is happening and what, if anything, can be done about this. What would you do about CEO pay? And Wednesday, we'll talk about alternative energy. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our media roundtable, and we are joined by Michael McAuliffe, senior congressional correspondent with the Huffington Post, and Mike Elk, labor journalist with In These Times. We are talking about media coverage of this budget deal that's being hailed in the media as a compromise that prevented another government shutdown. But where are the details about what's actually in this bill? We will also talk about the growing movement for low-wage workers. So before we get into the details, Michael, what else can you tell us? I mean, where are the savings coming from? Because that's also missing in a lot of these stories.
Well, not all of it is savings. I mean, there's I'm blanking on the exact number, but they're going to institute about a $5 fee on every one-way ticket, airplane ticket originating at a city in the United States. So that's, you know, just about $11 every time you take a round trip anywhere. And that'll raise quite a lot of money. Some of the savings, I mean, there's other fees, various, you know, visa fees and things like that. It's a really long, complicated laundry list of them. But the biggest chunk of savings is $28 billion that they're getting simply by extending the sequester. That's the across-the-board budget cuts that we're all living under, right? Mm-hmm. 2 years to 2022 and 2023. It's a 2% across-the-board cut to providers in Medicare, and that primarily means hospitals. So that's where those savings are coming. You also mentioned doctors under Medicare before. They have what's known as the doc fix. The standard growth rate, I believe, is what it refers to. And that was passed in a law. I'm blanking on the year, but it's more than 10 years ago now, I believe. And that is supposed to control costs in Medicare. It's due to cut Medicare payments to doctors by 24%. So they've got a three-month stopgap on that so the doctors don't lose their payments. But that also comes from sort of a strange extension of sequestration, which will also hit hospitals. But they did some weird budget gimmickry so that it hits mostly in 1 year and then it's better in the next year. But it puts it all within what they call the 10-year budget window. So for both of those programs, they're sort of taken out of hospitals 10 years from now.
Mm. Well, and we did a show about this on Tuesday, and California has one of the lowest reimbursement rates. And that's why a lot of doctors say they won't be able to take new patients under the Affordable Care Act, because another 2 million people in California now can get on Medicare, and they're expecting that many people to sign up. So you can listen to that show at yourcallradio.org. And Mike, because you focus on union issues and workers' rights, how does this affect workers? MSNBC has a piece called Federal Budget Deal Hits Worker Pensions by Ned Reznikoff. New federal employees are going to feel the sting from the budget deal. Of the proposed nearly $1 trillion in savings, an estimated $6 billion comes out of the pensions of any federal workers hired after December 31st. Those newer workers will have to pay for 4.4% of their salary, more than five times what older employees would pay. So how does this affect average workers? Mike?
Did we lose Mike?
Yeah. Mike, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry about that.
It's a bad deal for most workers. A pension is obviously they're going to have to contribute more to the pensions. There's not another increase for federal employees. Sequestration doesn't go into effect. And, you know, Mike and I both live in D.C., and I'm sure Mike, like I does, have many friends that work in federal government. And a lot of the people I know that came to D.C. around 2008, 2009, when I graduated from college, came to get government jobs because they were secure in a financial crisis. And now a lot of those folks I know are saying they don't want to work in government anymore because, you know, there might be shutdown, there might be sequestration, they might have to pay more for pensions. And at the end of the day, this leads more people that are very smart, that are very skilled, into corporate America doing evil things as opposed to working for public service because of how much more difficult it is getting to work in public service. The deal, though, what really concerns me about this deal, you know, I don't cover Congress really that much. You know, I'm mainly out covering workers and lockouts and organizing drives and that kind of stuff. But is the unemployment getting cut? My mother recently lost her job as a result of some austerity measures in the state of Pennsylvania. She was a social worker. And, you know, she used to work, when I was born, she was an auto worker. And when, you know, her Volkswagen plant in Westmoreland County, Pennsylvania closed, she was making $13.56 an hour. That was in 1988. The plant closed. My mother had to take a lot of jobs working as a waitress, doing all kind of stuff, working as a waitress at night, going to school during the day, and having absolutely no time for anything, and just being poor, you know, going to food banks, doing that kind of thing. And it took my mother basically 25 years to get back up to making what she's making now, making, you know, above $13.56 an hour. And that's not even including inflation. It took my mother 25 years and having to go back and get a bachelor's degree and do all this very difficult stuff and do everything that people said that they needed to do in a changing economy that was becoming a service economy. Yeah. And now my mother's lost her job. And now not only has she lost her job because of austerity, now unemployment is getting cut. And when I talk to my mother just says that she's just upset, pissed about the whole system, and upset and just feels disenfranchised from it, feels fed up. And if you look at where I was born, Westmoreland County, Pennsylvania, in western Pennsylvania, you know, when I was 2 years old, Michael Dukakis won the county by 56% in a year that was a landslide loss for him. You know, in 2008, you know, McCain won the district by 56% or so. And what's really happening that concerns me with these budget cuts, it's just not the economic effect that it has on people like my mother, but the effect that it has on people like my mother and so many people around her, the feeling that nobody represents them. They've done everything they're supposed to do, gone back to school, worked jobs, taken less pay, sucked it up, and still nobody represents them. And I think what it does is disenfranchises people from the political process. And when those people get disenfranchised, you know, what winds up happening is that the crazy right winds up winning more. And that's what I see as the big effect of this. It's just the political disenfranchisement of the voices of regular working folk.
Hmm. Well, Michael, do reporters on Capitol Hill bring up these issues? Because 1.3 million people without unemployment benefits is a huge deal. And, I mean, there's some headlines on this. The Toledo Blade wrote about it. The Washington Post, NPR has a piece. But it seems like it's not really getting as much attention as it was a couple of years ago. And the fact is, a lot of people are still struggling and are having a really hard time finding a job. So are reporters raising these questions?
You know, they're not raising them up here on Capitol Hill with as much frequency as they did. I mean, I do hear people ask them. A lot of the answers are fairly bland, which might be part of the reason why you're not seeing as many stories. But also, the members of Congress are not going to the mat to fight for unemployment insurance the way they did a couple of years ago. You know, part of it is they feel like the economy is going in the right direction, although at 7%, it's much worse than it was, you know, the last time they had a whole series of extensions of unemployment benefits. But I feel like there's such a almost a battle fatigue, you know, amongst the representatives up here that when Nancy Pelosi says, you know, embrace the suck, it's almost as like we can't have another showdown, shutdown fight up here. So we're gonna let unemployment go and try and get it as soon as we come back. Now, that felt like a more solid promise from Harry Reid because he's in the majority in the Senate, and they can probably try and do something up here. There are some Republicans in the Senate who would go along with Reid, so he has a decent chance at that. But, you know, then you get back to the House where, you know, Boehner, who bucked the Tea Party and got the budget deal through, is saying that any unemployment insurance extension needs to be paid for with corresponding cuts elsewhere, which is not the historical standard for emergency funding like that. So I think that's part of it. There's just such a weariness amongst the lawmakers and a sort of cloistered press up here with all the fights. So that might account for some of why it's not getting as much coverage, and also the possibility that they will do it when they come back in January.
And that is Michael McAuliffe, senior congressional correspondent for The Huffington Post. Mike Elk is a labor reporter for In These Times, and it's our media roundtable. We're discussing coverage of the budget. We'll also talk about this $595 billion military spending bill that just passed. It's not really getting that much attention. And then we will also talk about the growing movement for low-wage workers. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. What do you make of the coverage of the budget? What about the details? Are you hearing these very important details about unemployment and pensions, Medicare reimbursements? I mean, there's a lot of things in this bill that go beyond what John Boehner says about the Tea Party and Nancy Pelosi saying that the bill basically sucks. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Linda in Santa Cruz. Hi, Linda. Welcome to the show.
Hello and good morning. Thank you for your program. I wanted to speak to a couple of issues. The fellow that was talking about his mother that went back to school and the issues she's facing, I've faced them as well. I'm currently in it. And since I live in Santa Cruz, there's another issue of the aspect of reimbursement for medical care and medical issues. Santa Cruz is a rather provincial town, and we already get lower reimbursements for Medicare due to the nature of how they list Santa Cruz as a rural area. So we're going to have a shortage of doctors who will take Medi-Cal now, and we're going to have, that's probably going to, I don't know how much it will compound it, but it will be difficult. And then the other thing I wanted to speak to was Nancy Pelosi's comment. I am so tired of our officials telling us we have to suck it up, and they don't. And I just don't understand why this, in this country, a democratic country, allegedly, our governing officials continue to place themselves above the law and have the expectation that we should conduct ourselves lawfully while they don't.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Nancy. And again, in an interview with CNN's Jake Tapper, this was off camera, Nancy Pelosi said she told House members that the deal may be unsatisfactory, but they should, quote, embrace the suck. She refused to say that it sucks on camera, but she did say it off camera. Michael McAuliffe, since you're in D.C., I mean, so many people have similar sentiments. They feel the same way as Linda. What are your thoughts about this, and what can people actually do about this?
Well, I sound a little bit like a broken record on this, but in spite of your folks' disenchantment and displeasure with the system, the only thing that you can do is go vote. I mean, so many people in the country don't vote. Maybe some folks like it that way. Maybe the activists who do activate their base, especially on the right, like it that way. But that's the way to change it, is purely by voting. The one thing that politicians actually respond to is the threat of losing.
Well, or Mike Elk, take to the streets, which is what so many low-wage workers are doing right now who are not unionized. And in the case of Walmart, 114 have either been fired or, 114 have been fired according to the National Labor Relations Board, and they might actually investigate Walmart because of this. Mike? Did we lose Mike Elk? Okay, I think we'll call him back. Michael, what are your thoughts on these low-wage workers taking to the streets? I mean, this is now getting massive media coverage.
It is, and it's weird since I'm sort of partially in the bubble. I actually live in suburban Maryland where there are some real people. But the Occupy Wall Street, which got that huge, huge amount of coverage, it didn't really pierce the sort of consciousness of most of the lawmakers up here. Very much, and I think it goes back to the issue of the voting, because until that movement starts bearing fruit in the similar fashion that the Tea Party movement did in 2009, where people actually went out and voted in 2010, and hence you had this corresponding gridlock over here, especially in the House, where people were elected by that movement. Then they sort of look at it and they say, yeah, okay, where's that going to go? You know, the people who are already sort of predisposed to be sympathetic to people taking to the streets and to a movement like that will use the opportunity to try and raise the profile, and they'll say positive things. But so seldom do you see protests, movements like that accomplishing much anymore in Congress, unless the members feel like there's some teeth coming soon thereafter.
Hmm.
So that's the only thing that gives me hope for immigration reform, by the way, because I think some folks see some teeth there.
Oh, yeah, and we're going to talk about that on Monday.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like I sound like a broken record here, because when we talk about budgets, we talk about the budget that's passed, and then we talk about the military spending bill budget that doesn't really get much attention at a time when food stamps are being cut. I mean, you name the social service and it's being cut. But the House just voted, it was a 315-109 vote on this $595 billion military spending bill. The final bill won broad support from Democrats. 95 of them joined Republicans to pass it. And, I mean, this includes a boost in spending on the missile defense program by $358 million to a whopping $9.5 billion. And Reuters reports that this is mandating an additional homeland defense radar and increasing funding for U.S.-Israeli cooperative efforts. So, I mean, how should reporters make the connection here between a budget that hits people when you're talking about pensions and unemployment benefits and then this military spending bill that is so massive?
Unfortunately, when covering the defense bill this year, I've been mostly focused on the sort of sexual assault aspects of it. So I'm not completely up to speed on the numbers, but that authorization level that you're talking about, and this is the National Defense Authorization Act of 2014, that's the formal name, it's not quite the same thing as a budget. It says you can do this, but in that very same budget that you were talking about, the defense spending level is not that high, so they're going to have to work that out. I mean, the actual appropriation, the actual money that gets sent to the military will be what it is, regardless of the authorization.
And Mike Elk, I know we need to let you go in a minute, but what are your thoughts on how the low-wage worker movement is being covered? What do you think is good about it, and what's left out?
I think, you know, Josh Idelson obviously has covered it a lot, who we talked about earlier. And, you know, he's done a good job in terms of sort of, covering a lot of the protests. But, you know, there's a lot of spin going on here, and I don't think some of that has been picked up. Arun Gupta wrote a piece for us called The Fight for 15 Confidential that kind of looks into a lot of this, what SEIU is doing, how this is more of a media strategy and more of a march on the media as opposed to organizing workers and marching on the boss, and how this is being very top-down driven at SEIU and not really empowering these low-wage workers and putting these low-wage workers in the driver's seat. And I talked to a lot of union leaders, and a lot of union leaders say, well, there's such high turnover rate among low-wage workers. You know, these folks, they're not around to do it, so it's all right if we lead the way. And, you know, you can hear people like Stephen Lerner, who's the architect of Justice for Janitors, argue that it's just the way it needs to be done. And it hasn't been enough of a discussion about that and whether or not that kind of top-down SEIU approach really creates a genuine low-wage workers movement.
But at the same time, I mean, these workers do have very clear demands. And, I mean, what's kind of amazing is they're not asking for much. I mean, the Walmart workers, who make on average about $18,000 a year, are asking for $25,000 a year with the opportunity to work full-time and to be sure that their schedules are set from week to week so they know when to get childcare, for example. So, I mean, they've got real demands on the table.
Yeah, they have very real demands on the table, but it's a question of how are they going to get to the table, how they're going to get these companies to the table, and is that going to be kind of an SEIU top-down driven media approach, or is it going to be workers very in the driver's seat? You know, if you're going to have workers at the table, they got to be in the driver's seat, is what a lot of folks I know would say.
And before we let you go, Mike, we're going to do a show about CEO pay on Tuesday. And in a lot of the reporting I've seen about the Walmart workers and the fast food workers, they fail to include the massive profits of Walmart and these fast food restaurants and the CEO pay. And we talked about this a bit on Tuesday, but a new report from the Institute for Policy Studies found that thanks to quote, performance pay, which is a deductible. CEOs in the fast food industry pocketed more than $183 million in deductible, quote, performance pay in 2011 and 2012, lowering their company's IRS bills by about $64 million. To put that figure in perspective, according to Bill Moyers, it would be enough to cover the average cost of food stamps for 40,000 American families for 1 year. How important is it to say in these stories that, for example, Yum Brands, which operates Taco Bell, KFC, and Pizza Hut, their CEO, David Novak, pocketed over $94 million in 2011 and 2012 in stock option gains and bonuses?
I think it's crucial. You know, I'm down here in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where there's a big union drive going on at Volkswagen. Volkswagen's an incredibly profitable company. Folks are only making $15 an hour making automobiles. They're selling for, you know, $30,000 or so. So it's a situation where I think reporters got to bring this up. There's got to be a real discussion, and I think all too often the window gets narrowed to the viewpoint of the boss, and you know, those kind of questions about profits, about CEO pay, are often not brought up enough. I think Stephen Greenhouse of the New York Times does an excellent job bringing it up. You know, he's really led the way on this kind of stuff, and it's good. I feel really bad. I have to run and go catch a flight.
Okay.
I love being on your show, Rose. I love you. You know, I hear there's an open shot slot at 4 p.m. on MSNBC. I hope you get it. It'd be great.
So. Well, yeah. Thank you, Mike. Thanks for that. And thank you so much for being on the show, and we'll have you back soon. Have a safe flight. That's Mike Elk, labor journalist with In These Times. If we can talk about the military budget, maybe that would be a good gig. We're joined by Michael McAuliffe, senior congressional correspondent with The Huffington Post. And Michael, we've got just a couple more minutes. What are your thoughts about, you know, media coverage of this growing gap between workers and CEOs and the profits that these corporations are bringing in? Do you think that reporters should include this information when they're writing about these massive protests that we're seeing on the streets?
Absolutely. I mean, that's part of the reason you're having the massive protests. And I do think you've seen a lot more coverage of this in the last, probably 2 years. And that's one of the things that I thought Occupy Wall Street helped push into everyone's attention is this. I think the gap is now reaching the proportions of the 1920s and the Great Gatsby. In fact, I saw a chart somewhere today that made that very point, that social mobility has in the United States is now amongst the lowest in all of the major democracies, and the income inequality is among the highest. So it's completely fair game to point that fact out, and it's certainly in regular folks' interest to know how little they're making relative to a very small number of people in the country.
Tax loopholes were at one point getting a lot of media attention, but in this budget bill, it fails to close even one single tax loophole. How much coverage is that, or how much attention is that getting in D.C.? Are reporters asking about that at all?
Yeah, I mean, Patty Murray and Paul Ryan did a fairly good job of sort of preempting that by saying straight out that this isn't going to be in there, and Democrats were, they didn't want to destroy the deal, so they weren't like getting up on the stump and yelling about it, but they were making the point that they couldn't get a concession on a single loophole during these negotiations. And I think you'll hear more of that when the deal is done. I think they're so afraid that the thing will fall apart and that it will be another example of failure and gridlock in Washington, that they're even afraid to risk this very, very modest and not very satisfying deal. Mm.
Shoshana in Oakland writes, I haven't been able to figure out how this is such a great compromise if Paul Ryan sat down at the table and announced there would be no new revenues. The New York Times had a pretty clear-eyed editorial yesterday regarding actual details of this so-called budget. Thank you for the email, Shoshana. And let's go to Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry. Thanks for holding.
Hi, yes, I want to ask Michael, but he's no longer there, is if there's nobody to vote for, if we vote, we basically can leave it blank, or we can, that's what I do, you know, if it's choice between, you know, obviously, you know, we have almost nobody, generally often only one candidate running a supervisor's race. Nancy Pelosi's worth about Wikipedia estimates somewhere around $60 million, according to a reliable source, and it could be quite a bit more than that. We just don't know, so it's no wonder she doesn't understand ordinary people. We had down the street from me, we have Nancy Pelosi Drive, which was named by executive order by Ed Lee. A mayor was appointed, and there was a mysterious campaign to make him run again, and then he ran again, and now he's doing a lot of things that many of us disagree with, but we have absolutely no input in government because there's not a single elected official who's really supporting us. That's the way a lot of us feel, and we see this whole neoliberal model really pulling us to the bottom, just as Michael said, and it doesn't. It seems like these people running things really have no relationship to reality and what's really happening, and how people's lives are affected, and they don't seem to want to listen.
Well,
because they're financially funded that way.
Thank you, Harry. Sorry to cut you off, but we're almost out of time, and Michael is still here. And Michael, just to let you know, Harry is, as you can tell, a very active person in San Francisco politics and follows all of these issues very closely. But a lot of people feel like he does and say, I would rather leave it blank.
Yeah, well, then you let someone else fill in the blanks for you, and I, you know, the system isn't very satisfactory a lot of the time, but I think the more people are engaged, you get a different outcome. I don't think Barack Obama would have been elected president if the voter turnout hadn't risen correspondingly. A bigger turnout changes the election, and that's really where it comes down to. I mean, it's the politics is votes, and that's really a very baseline issue.
And Michael, just quickly, what are you working on right now?
Right now, I am working on trying to figure out how important that the sort of Tea Party thing is. I mean, does it really make much of a difference? I don't know, and I'm trying to figure that out.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to reading that. Michael McAuliffe, senior congressional correspondent with The Huffington Post. Thanks again for joining us.
All right. Thanks, Rose.
Thank you. Have a good weekend. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. So many people being deported. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the alarming rate of deportations and prospects for immigration reform. Under President Obama, almost 2 million undocumented immigrants have been deported. Immigrant rights activists are taking part in nationwide demonstrations urging the president to stop the deportations. So what explains this policy, and what's the status of immigration reform? Join the conversation and call in with your questions on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.